In South America, he estimated, the minimum probability that a pathogen in one host will next encounter a host with a similar immune spectrum is about 28%. In Europe, the chance is less than 2%. As a result, Black argued, people of the New World are unusually susceptible to diseases of the old. Because the point is persistently misunderstood, it bears repeating that Indians' relative genetic homogeneity does not imply genetic inferiority. Even a champion of Indians, like historian Francis Jennings, got this wrong. The Europeans' capacity to resist certain diseases, he wrote in his polemical Invasion of America, made them superior in the pure Darwinian sense to the Indians. No, Spaniards simply represented a wider genetic array. Asserting their superiority is like saying that the motley mob at a football game is somehow intrinsically superior to the closely related attendees of a family reunion. Actually, some old world populations were just as vulnerable as Native Americans to those diseases, and likely for the same reason. Indians' closest genetic relatives are indigenous Siberians. They did not come into substantial contact with Europeans until the 16th century, when Russian fur merchants overturned their governments, established military outposts throughout the region, and demanded furs in tribute. In the train of the Russian fur market came Russian diseases, notably smallpox. The parallels with the Indian experience are striking. In 1768, the virus struck Siberia's Pacific coast, apparently for the first time. No one knows how many have survived, confessed the governor of Irkutsk, the Russian base on Lake Baikal, apparently because officials were afraid to travel to the affected area. A decade later, in 1779, the round-the-globe expedition of Captain James Cook reached Kamchatka, the long peninsula on the Pacific coast. The shoreline, the British discovered, was a cemetery. We everywhere met with the ruins of large villages with no traces left of them but the foundation of the houses, lamented David Samwell, the ship's surgeon. The Russians told us that the villages were destroyed by the smallpox. The explorer, Martin Sauer, who visited Kamchatka 5 years after Cook's expedition, discovered that the Russian government had at last ventured into the former epidemic zone. Scarcely 1,000 natives remained on the peninsula, according to official figures. The disease had claimed more than 5,000 lives. The tally cannot be taken as exact, but the fact remains. A single epidemic killed more than 3 of every 4 indigenous Siberians in that area. After a few such experiences, the natives tried to fight back. As soon as indigenous Siberians learn that smallpox or other contagious diseases are in town, the political exile Heinrich von Fuch wrote, they set up sentries along all the roads, armed with bows and arrows, and they will not allow anyone to come into their settlements from town. Likewise, they will not accept Russian flour or other gifts, lest they be contaminated with smallpox. Their efforts were in vain. Despite extreme precautions, disease cut down native Siberians again and again. After learning about this sad history, I again telephoned Francis Black. Being genetically determined, Indian HLA homogeneity cannot be changed, except by intermarriage with non-Indians. Did that mean that the epidemics were unavoidable, I asked? Suppose that the peoples of the Americas had, in some parallel world, understood the concept of contagion and been prepared to act on it. Could the mass death have been averted? There have been lots of cases where individual towns kept out epidemics, Black said. During plague episodes, medieval cities would barricade themselves behind their walls and kill people who tried to come in. But whole countries, that's much harder. England has kept out rabies. That's the biggest success story that comes to mind offhand. But rabies is primarily an animal disease, which helps, because you only have to watch the ports. You don't have many undocumented aliens sneaking in with sick dogs, and rabies is not highly contagious. So even if it slips through, it is unlikely to spread. He stopped speaking for long enough that I asked him if he was still on the line. I'm trying to imagine how you would do it, he said. If Indians in Florida let in sick people, the effects could reach all the way up to here in Connecticut. So all these different groups would have had to coordinate the blockade together. And they'd have to do it for centuries, 400 years, until the invention of vaccines. Naturally, they'd want to trade, furs for knives, that kind of thing. But the trade would have to be conducted in antiseptic conditions. The Abenaki sent goods to Verrazano on a rope strung from ship to shore, I said. You'd have to have the entire hemisphere doing that. And the Europeans would presumably have to cooperate, or most of them anyway. I can't imagine that happening, actually, any of it. Did that mean the epidemics were inevitable and there was nothing to be done? The authorities, he replied, could try to maintain isolation, as I was saying. But that ends up being paternalistic and ineffective. Or they can endorse marriage and procreation with outsiders, which risks destroying the society they supposedly are trying to preserve. I'm not sure what I'd recommend, except getting these communities some decent health care, which they almost never have. Except for death, he went on, nothing in medicine is inevitable. But I don't see how it, waves of epidemics from European diseases, could have been prevented for very long. That's a terrible thought. But I've been working with highly contagious diseases for 40 years, and I can tell you that in the long run, it is almost impossible to keep them out. In 2004, two U.S. anthropologists and a Venezuelan medical researcher proposed that Native American susceptibility to infectious disease might have a second cause, helper T cells, which, like the HLAs, help the immune system recognize foreign objects. To simplify considerably, helper T cells occur in two main types, one that targets microorganisms and one that targets parasites. The body cannot sustain large numbers of both, and hence, adult immune systems tend to be skewed toward one or the other, usually depending on whether, as children, they were more often exposed to microorganisms or parasites. Indians have historically been burdened by flukes, tapeworms, and nematodes, so they have long had majorities of parasite-fighting helper T cells. Europeans, who grew up in germ-filled environments, usually lean the other way. As a result, the three researchers suggested, adult Indians were, and possibly still are, more vulnerable to infectious diseases than adult Europeans. Conversely, Europeans would be comparatively more vulnerable to parasites. If further research supports this hypothesis, preventing childhood parasite infections might allow Indian immune systems to orientate themselves toward bacteria and viruses, possibly reducing future deaths. Our eyes were appalled with terror. A second reason historians believe that epidemics tore through Native American communities before Europeans arrived is that epidemics also did it after Europeans arrived. In her book, Pox Americana, 2001, the Duke University historian Elizabeth Fenn meticulously pieced together evidence that the Western Hemisphere was visited by two smallpox pandemics shortly before and during the Revolutionary War. The smaller of the two apparently began outside Boston in early 1774 and lurked in the area for the next several years like a sniper, picking off victims at the rate of 10 to 30 a day. In Boston, the Declaration of Independence was overshadowed by the previous day's proclamation of a citywide campaign of inoculation, an early risky form of vaccination in which people deliberately infected themselves with a mild dose of smallpox to produce immunity. Even as it besieged Boston, the virus also spread down the eastern seaboard, laying waste as far as Georgia. It wreaked havoc on the Aniyonuiya, the group often called the Cherokee, which is a mildly insulting name coined by their enemies, the Creek Confederation, and the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous name for the Six Nations that made up what Europeans call the Iroquois League. Both were important allies of the British, and after the epidemic, neither was able to fight the colonists successfully. Smallpox also ruined the British plan to raise an army of slaves and indentured servants by promising them freedom after the war. The disease killed off most of the Ethiopian regiment, even as it assembled. An equal opportunity killer, smallpox ravaged the rebels too. The virus had been endemic in Europe for centuries, which meant that most Europeans were exposed to it before adulthood. But it was only an occasional, terrible visitor in the Americas, which meant that most adult colonists had not acquired childhood immunity. On an individual level, they were almost as vulnerable as Indians. On a group level, though, they were less genetically homogeneous, which conferred some relative advantage. The virus would sweep through them, but not kill quite so many. Still, so many soldiers in the Continental Army fell during the epidemic that revolutionary leaders feared that the disease would bring an end to their revolt. The smallpox, John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail. What shall we do with it? His worries were on target. The virus, not the British, stopped the Continental Army's drive into Quebec in 1776. In retrospect, Fenn told me, one of George Washington's most brilliant moves was to inoculate the army against smallpox during the Valley Forge winter of 78. Without inoculation, she said, the smallpox epidemic could easily have handed the colonies back to the British. Even as the first outbreak faded, Fenn wrote, a second, apparently unrelated epidemic burned through Mexico City. The first cases occurred in August 1779. By year's end, perhaps 18,000 had died in the city area, and the disease was racing through the countryside in every direction. Communications in those days were too poor to permit us to document a transmission chain. But records show smallpox flaring in separate explosions to the south, like a chain of firecrackers. Guatemala, 1780-81, Colombia, 1781-83, Ecuador, 1783. Was the virus retracing a journey to Tawantinsuyu Suyu it had taken before? It seems likely, decided Calloway, the Dartmouth historian. Fenn tried to trace the virus as it went north. Like Dobbins, she examined parish burial records. In 1780, a telltale surge of mortality traveled north along the heavily traveled road to Santa Fe. From there, smallpox apparently exploded into most of Western North America. First to suffer, or so the sketchy evidence suggests, were the Hopi. Already reeling from a drought, they were blasted by smallpox. As many as 9 out of 10 may have died. When the Spanish governor tried to recruit the Hopi to live in missions, their leaders told him not to bother. The epidemic soon would expunge them from the earth. As if drought and contagion were not enough, the Hopi were constantly under attack by the Nermina, or Nemina, a fluid collection of hunting bands known today as the Comanche. The name awarded by an enemy group means people who fight us all the time. Originally based north of Santa Fe, the Nermina were on their way to dominating the southern plains. They had driven away their Apache and Hopi rivals with triphammer ambushes and deadly incursions, and were bent on doing the same to any European colonists who ventured in. In 1781, the raiding abruptly stopped. Silence for 18 months. Was the ceasefire due to Mexico City smallpox that had been transmitted by the Hopi? 4 years afterward, a traveler noted in his diary that the Nermina lived in fear of disease because they had been recently struck by smallpox. Tenuous but suggestive evidence. What is certain is that both Hopi and Nermina were part of a network of exchange that had hummed with vitality since ancient times, and had recently grown more intense with the arrival of horses, which sped up communication. Smallpox raced along the network through the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains, ricocheting along the Mandan, Hidatsa, Ojibwe, Crow, Blackfoot, and Shoshone. A helter-skelter progress in which the virus leapfrogged from central Mexico to the shore of Hudson Bay in less than 2 years. Indians in the northern Great Plains kept winter counts, oral chronologies of the most important events in each year. Often, the counts were accompanied by a spiraling sequence of drawings on a hide, with each year summarized by a drawing as an aide-memoire. In several Lakota Sioux counts, 1780-81, was bleakly summed up as the year of smallpox used them up. And the Lakota were not the only ones affected. In 1781, a company of Blackfoot stumbled across a Shoshone camp at dawn near the Red Deer River in Alberta. The Blackfoot were a tightly organized confederation of groups that inhabited the plains between the Missouri and Saskatchewan rivers. Equipped with guns and horses from French traders, they had pushed their southern neighbors, the Shoshone, left at a disadvantage because they had no access to the French and their goods, and the Spanish, whom they did have access to, tried to block Indian access to weapons, from the plains into the mountains of what are now Wyoming and Colorado. When the Shoshone finally obtained guns, they traded with their linguistic cousins, the Nurmerna, who took the weapons as booty from defeated Spaniards. Open warfare broke out. In this bellicose context, the Blackfoot Party knew exactly what to do when it happened upon a slumbering Shoshone encampment. With sharp flat daggers and knives, one of the raiders later remembered, they silently sliced open the Shoshone tents and entered for the fight, but our war whoops instantly stopped. Our eyes were appalled with terror. There was no one to fight with but the dead and the dying, each a mass of corruption. The Blackfoot did not touch the bodies, but were infected anyway. When the company returned home, the raider lamented, smallpox spread from one tent to another as if the bad spirit carried it. According to Fenn, the great preponderance of the evidence indicates that the Shoshone also transmitted smallpox down the Columbia River into the Pacific Northwest. Calloway suggests the Crow as a plausible alternative. Whoever passed on the virus, its effects were still visible a decade later in 1792, when the British navigator George Vancouver led the first European expedition to survey Puget Sound. Like Cook's crew in Kamchatka, he found a charnel house. Deserted villages, abandoned fishing boats, human remains, promiscuously scattered about the beach in great numbers. Everything they saw suggested that at no very remote period this country had been far more populous than at present. The few suffering survivors, noted Second Lieutenant Peter Puget, were most terribly pitted. Indeed, many have lost their eyes. Europeans were well versed in the brutal logic of quarantine. When plague appeared, they boarded up houses and fled to the countryside. By contrast, the historian Neil Salisbury observed, family and friends in Indian New England gathered at the sufferer's bedside to wait out the illness, a practice that could only have served to spread the disease more rapidly. Even the idea of contagion itself was novel. We had no belief that one man could give a disease to another, the Blackfoot raider remembered, any more than a wounded man could give his wound to another. Because they knew of no protective measures, the toll was even higher than it would have been. Living in the era of antibiotics, we find it difficult to imagine the simultaneous deaths of siblings, parents, relatives, and friends. As if by a flash of grim light, Indian villages became societies of widows, widowers, and orphans. Parents lost their children, and children were suddenly alone. Rare is the human spirit that remains buoyant in a Holocaust. My people have been so unhappy for so long, they wish to disincrease rather than to multiply, a Paiute woman wrote in 1883. A Lakota winter count memorialized the year 1784 with a stark image. A pox-scarred man alone in a teepee shooting himself. Disease not only shattered the family bonds that were the underlying foundation of Indian societies, it wiped out the political superstructure at the top. King Liholio Kamehameha II and Queen Kamamalu of Hawaii visited Great Britain on a diplomatic mission in 1824. While staying in a posh London hotel and attending the theater in the English king's own box, the royal couple and most of the rest of their party came down with measles. It killed the queen on July 8th. The grieving king died 6 days later at the age of 27. The death of the royal couple ushered in a time of social chaos. It was as catastrophic for Hawaii as the death of Waina Kapak for Tawantinsuyu. A particularly poignant loss occurred in the summer of 1701, when the leaders of 40 Native nations convened in Montreal to negotiate an end to decades of war among themselves and the French. Death stalked the Congress in the form of influenza. By then, the Indians of the Northeast knew such diseases all too well. Sickness had carried off so many members of the Haudenosaunee that the alliance was forced to replenish itself by adopting abductees and prisoners of war. At the time of the conference, at least a quarter of the Haudenosaunee were former captives. At great personal risk, many Indian leaders attended the conference even after they knew that influenza was in Montreal. Dozens died. Among them was the Huron leader, Kondiaronk, a famed orator who had, more than any other, convened the gathering as a last-ditch effort to avoid internecine conflict. His body was placed on a bed of beaver pelts, covered by a scarlet cloth, and surrounded by a copper pot, a rifle, and a sword. In their diversity, the objects symbolized the peaceful mixing of cultures that Kondiaronk hoped lay in the future. Nobody knows how many died during the pandemics of the 1770s and 1780s. But even if one had a number, it wouldn't begin to tally the impact. Disease turned whole societies to ash. Six Cree groups in Western Canada disappeared after 1781. The Blackfoot Nation, blasted by smallpox, sent peace emissaries to Shoshone bands, only to find that all had vanished. The country to the south was empty and silent, Calloway wrote. So broken were the Omaha by disease that, according to tradition, they launched a deliberately suicidal attack against their enemies. Those who did not die quit their villages and became homeless wanderers. Cultures are like books, the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss once remarked. Each a volume in the great library of humankind. In the 16th century, more books were burned than ever before or since. How many Homers vanished? How many Hesiods? What great works of painting, sculpture, architecture, and music vanished or never were created? Languages, prayers, dreams, habits, and hopes, all gone. And not just once, but over and over again. In our antibiotic era, how can we imagine what it means to have entire ways of life hiss away like steam? How can one assay the total impact of the unprecedented calamity that gave rise to the world we live in? It seems important to try. I would submit that the best way to come near to encompassing the scale and kind of the loss, and its causes, is to look at the single case where the intellectual life of a Native American society is almost as well documented as its destruction. Flowers and Song. In 1524, according to colonial accounts, an extraordinary face-off took place in one of the great buildings of Tenochtitlan, capital of the Triple Alliance, the Aztec Empire, as it is better known, which Hernan Cortes had conquered 3 years before. Historians increasingly shy away from the term Aztec because the 19th century naturalist Alexander von Humboldt coined it in a misapprehension. Humboldt's Aztecs were actually the people of three nations, the members of the Triple Alliance. Facing each other across a room, two delegations of elite clerics battled over the nature of God. On one side were 12 eminent Franciscan monks who had traveled from Europe in a mission authorized by Pope Hadrian VI. On the other were 12 high priests from the Triple Alliance, men who had wielded immense spiritual and political power until Cortes shuttered the grand temples and brought down the clerisy. Although the Pope in Rome had authorized the friars' mission, all 12 were Spanish, because Spain had conquered the empire, and because Spain, which had spent centuries extracting itself from the rule of African Muslims, had experience with powerful alien ideologies. Analogously, the priests of the Triple Alliance were probably all Mexica. The Mexica were the dominant partner in the alliance, and they had founded and populated Tenochtitlan, the empire's biggest city. The Franciscans' mission had begun with a request by Cortes. Cortes believed that the military conquest of the alliance had to be accompanied and justified by an equivalent spiritual conquest. The Indians, he said, must be led to salvation. And he asked King Charles V of Spain for some priests to do the job. In turn, the king turned to the Pope for his blessing and advice. Cortes did not want bishops and pampered prelates, wrote historian William H. Prescott, who too often squandered the substance of the church in riotous living, but men of unblemished purity of life, nourished with the learning of the cloister, who counted all personal sacrifices as little in the cause to which they were devoted. Led by the intellectual Martín de Valencia, a man so dedicated to ascetic faith that he ended his days as a hermit in the Mexican desert, the friars intended to guide Spain's new subjects along the exhilarating path to Christendom. The monks understood that the Mexica already had a church, a false church intended to snare their souls for the devil, but a church nonetheless. And they knew that the Indians were too numerous to be reached by even the most zealous missionaries. Valencia's plan was conversion by proxy. He and the rest of the 12 would open the eyes of the Indian priesthood to the beauties of the true faith, gaining their adherence by reasoned theological discussion. And then the priests would fan out and spread the gospel in their native tongue. The sole record of the discussions between the monks and the Mexica were compiled 4 decades later by another Franciscan, Bernardino de Sahagún. Sahagún knew 10 of the 12 Spaniards at the meeting, interviewed 4 of the Mexica priests, and filled in gaps by extrapolating from similar theological discussions in which he had participated. Written in dialogue verse, an opera seria exchange of long recitatives, his reconstruction does not individually identify the speakers. Perhaps, some historians believe, because the great meeting did not actually take place. Sahagún's account being a distillation of many smaller encounters. Only part of the original manuscript survives, written in Nahuatl, the Mexican language, which Sahagún learned to speak fluently. Still, what remains is enough to indicate how the Mexica viewed their position vis-a-vis the Spanish, defeated but not unequal. In Sahagún's reconstruction, the Franciscans speak first, their interpreters struggling to make European concepts clear in Nahuatl verse, the language of high discourse. The monks explain that they have been sent by the one who on the earth is the greater speaker of divine things, the Pope, to bring the venerable word of the one sole true God to New Spain. By worshipping at false altars, the friars say, you cause him an injured heart by which you live in his anger, his ire. So infuriated was the Christian God by the Indians' worship of idols and demons that he sent out the Spaniards, those who afflicted you with tormenting sorrow by which you were punished so that you ceased these not few injuries to his precious heart. The Triple Alliance was subjugated, in other words, because its people had failed to recognize the one true God. By accepting the Bible, the priests explain, the Mexica will be able to cool the heart of he by whom all live, so he will not completely destroy you. The Mexica respond immediately. Not wanting to join Christendom, they also know that they cannot prevail in a direct confrontation with their conquerors. Shrewdly, they try to shift the terms of the argument to more congenial rhetorical grounds, an approach that will force the friars to treat them as equals. What now immediately will we say? The lead cleric asks. We are those who shelter the people. We are mothers to the people, fathers to the people. Translation. We priests are in the same business as you Franciscans. We are high-ranking clerics, elite intellectuals, just like you. And just like you, we have a function, providing comfort and meaning to the common folk. To disavow their faith, the Mexica say, would tear apart their lives. For this reason and others, the priests explain, we cannot yet agree to Christianity ourselves. We do not yet make it true for ourselves. Behind the priest's refusal is an implied request. You know what it is like to be in our shoes. You carry the same responsibilities. As one group of highly placed religious functionaries to another, don't do this to us. Having expected childlike natives, empty vessels waiting to be filled by the word. The Franciscans instead found themselves fencing with skilled rhetoricians, proud of their intellectual traditions. In the end, the friars resorted to a crude but effective argument. The Indians had to pledge fealty to the Christian God, because their own gods were not powerful enough to liberate them from the hands of the Spaniards. In a sober ceremony, the Mexica abjured their old religion and embraced Christianity. For more than a decade, Sahagún and other religious authorities regarded the conversion as a triumph. He initially began his reconstruction of the debate to commemorate it, but he never published the manuscript, because he was slowly coming to believe that the Church's efforts in New Spain had been a failure. Despite lip service devotion to the gospel, the Mexica remained outside Christendom, as do some of their descendants to this day. Sahagún is known as the first American anthropologist, for he labored for decades to understand the Indians he sought to convert. With other missionaries, he amassed an archive on the Mexica and their neighbors. Dynastic histories, dictionaries of native languages, descriptions of customs, collections of poetry and drama, galleries of paintings and sculpture, unequaled by that on any other Indian group. Even the Inca. From it emerges, in almost full detail, a group portrait of a kind that is usually obscured by loss. Masters of power politics, engineers of genius. The Mexica were also upstarts and pretenders, arrivistas who falsely claimed a brilliant line of descent. They are best known for assembling the greatest empire ever seen in Mesoamerica. But their finest accomplishment may have been the creation of a remarkable intellectual tradition, one that, like the Greeks, began with the questions of lyric poets and then went on to distinct schools of inquiry associated with elite academies. Mexica histories begin by relating their migration to the Basin of Mexico. Fringed by mountains, the basin was about 100 miles long from north to south, and perhaps half that size from east to west. At its center was Lake Texcoco, a 50-mile-long volcanic lake with exceptionally clear, clean water. Around the time of Christ, a small village on its northeast periphery named Teotihuacan emerged as a military power. During the next four centuries, its realm steadily expanded until it ruled directly over much of central Mexico, and indirectly, through puppet governments, as far south as Guatemala. Its eponymous capital then may have had 200,000 inhabitants, enormous at the time. Its ruins, an hour by bus from Mexico City, are among the few remnants of the ancient world that today don't seem small. The city was organized around the Avenue of the Dead, a miles-long north-south boulevard that cut straight as an axe stroke across the landscape. From the northern end of the avenue rose the pyramids of the sun and moon, each as big as the biggest Egyptian pyramids. To their south sprawled the Temple of the Feathered Serpent, where the empire's rulers, as ruthless and preoccupied with national glory as so many Bismarcks, considered what to do with their soldiers. Despite the empire's fame and power, its history is still little known. Archaeologists do not know what language its people spoke, or even its proper name. Teotihuacan was coined centuries later. It had writing of some kind, though it seems not to have been used much. In any case, the script has not been deciphered. Teotihuacan fell in the 8th century for reasons yet unknown, but left an enduring mark in central Mexico. 300 years afterward, the rising Toltecs styled themselves its heirs. They too built an empire, which fell amid internal dissension in about 1200 AD. The collapse of the Toltec created an opening in the warm, fertile basin. Into it moved half a dozen groups from the northern and western desert, the Mexica among them. The Mexica were an unlikely choice for heir to the imperial tradition of Teotihuacan and the Toltecs. Poor and unsophisticated, they probably came to Lake Texcoco about 1250 AD and became vassals of more important groups. Eventually, some enemies drove them away from the fertile shore. The Mexica fled to a swampy, uninhabited island. According to an account by Hernando Alvaro Tezozomoc, grandson of the last Mexica ruler, The refugees stumbled about the island for days, looking for food and a place to settle, until one of the priests had a vision in a dream. In the dream, the Mexica's patron deity instructed his people to look in the swamp for a cactus. Standing on the cactus, the god promised, "You shall see an eagle warming itself in the sun." And the next morning, once more, they went in among the rushes, in among the reeds, to the edge of the spring. And when they came out into the reeds, there at the edge of the spring was the tenochtli, a cactus fruit. And they saw an eagle on the tenochtli, perched on it, standing on it. It was eating something. It was feeding. It was pecking at what it was eating. And when the eagle saw the Mexica, he bowed his head low. Its nest, its palate, was of every kind of precious feather. Of lovely cotinga feathers, roseate spoonbill feathers, quetzal feathers. And they also saw, strewn about the heads of sundry birds, the heads of precious birds strung together, and some birds' feet and bones. And the god called out to them. He said to them, "O Mexica, it shall be there." But the Mexica did not see who spoke. It was for this reason that they call it Tenochtitlan. And the Mexica wept. They said, "O happy, O blessed are we. We have beheld the city that shall be ours. Let us go now. Let us rest." This was in the year 1325. In this way came into being Tenochtitlan, sole rival in size and opulence to Teotihuacan. Among the Mexica, a council of clan elders chose the overall ruler, or rather, chose the overall rulers. The Mexica divided authority between a Tlatoani, literally, speaker, a diplomatic and military commander who controlled relations with other groups, and a Cihuacuatl, literally, female serpent, who supervised internal affairs. For a century after Tenochtitlan's birth, the Tlatoani's position was unenviable. The Mexica were subordinated by a nearby city-state on the shore, and the Tlatoani was forced to send Mexica men as conscripts for its wars. Only in 1428 did Itzcoatl, a newly selected Tlatoani, ally with two other small vassal states to overthrow their mutual overlords. In victory, the three groups officially formed the Triple Alliance, with the Mexica the most powerful leg of the tripod. Like Tawantinsuyu, the empire grew rapidly. Its presiding genius was not Itzcoatl, though, but his nephew, Tlacaelel, 1398 to 1480. During his long life, Tlacaelel was twice offered the position of Tlatoani, but turned it down both times. Preferring the less glorious and supposedly less influential position of Cihuacuatl, head of internal affairs, he ruled from behind the scenes, dominating the alliance for more than 50 years and utterly re-engineering Mexica society. Born to an elite family, Tlacaelel first became known at the age of 30, when he inspired the Mexica to revolt against their masters, supervised the gestation of the alliance, and served as Itzcoatl's general during the assault. After the victory, he met with Itzcoatl and the Mexica clan leaders. In addition to taking slaves and booty, wartime victors in central Mexico often burned their enemies' codices, the hand-painted picture texts in which priests recorded their people's histories. Tlacaelel insisted that in addition to destroying the codices of their former oppressors, the Mexica should set fire to their own codices. His explanation for this idea can only be described as Orwellian. "It is not fitting that our people should know these pictures. Our people, our subjects, will be lost and our land destroyed, for these pictures are full of lies." The lies were the inconvenient fact that the Mexica past was one of poverty and humiliation. To motivate the people properly, Tlacaelel said, the priesthood should rewrite Mexica history by creating new codices, adding in the great deeds, whose lack now seemed embarrassing, and adorning their ancestry with ties to the Toltecs and Teotihuacan. A visionary and patriot, Tlacaelel believed that the Mexica were destined to rule a vast empire. But because ambition succeeds best when disguised by virtue, he wanted to furnish the alliance with an animating ideology, a manifest destiny as it were, or mission civilisatrice. He came up with a corker, a theogony that transformed the Mexica into keepers of the cosmic order. At its center was Huitzilopochtli, a martial god who wore a helmet shaped like a hummingbird's head and carried a fire-breathing serpent as a weapon. Huitzilopochtli had long been the Mexica's patron deity. It was he who had entered the Mexica priest's dream to explain where to found Tenochtitlan. After the formation of the Triple Alliance, Tlacaelel went about persuading the people, as one Mexica historian wrote, that Huitzilopochtli was not a mere tutelary deity, but a divinity essential to the fate of humankind. At the apex of the celestial hierarchy stood Ometeotl, the omnipresent sustainer of the cosmos, the lord of the close vicinity, in Nahuatl. In Tlacaelel's vision, Ometeotl had four sons, one of whom was Huitzilopochtli. These four sons had been vying for supremacy since the beginning of time. The history of the universe was mainly a record of their endless struggle. At intervals, the brothers would wrestle themselves into a precarious equilibrium. Like sumo giants straining motionlessly against each other in the ring, with one brother on top and the other three in a temporary, isometric balance below. In these interregnums of order, Tlacaelel explained, the topmost brother linked himself to the sun, on which all living creatures depend. In some versions of the story, the brother became the sun. In others, he merely supervised its workings. Either way, life could exist only when one brother held sway, and the cosmic battle quieted and the sun was able to shine. But when the balance came apart, as it always did, the brothers would resume their strife. The sun would go dark, sinking the cosmos into an endless, lethal night. Eventually, the suns would arrive at a new transitory order and reignite the sun, letting existence begin anew. This apocalyptic cycle had occurred four times before. The Mexica lived during the fifth sun, when the sun was identified with Huitzilopochtli. The sun's role was hellishly difficult, Tlacaelel said. Even when the strife among Ometeotl's sons quieted enough to allow the sun to shine, it still had to battle the stars and moon every day as it rose in the sky. A literal struggle of light against darkness. Each day of sunlight was a victory that must be fought and won again the next day. Because the sun cannot hold out forever against its foes, one 16th century Nahuatl account explained, it would one day inevitably lose. There was no getting around it. In the sun it shall come to pass, that the earth shall move, that there shall be famine, and that we all shall perish. But the calamity could be postponed, at least for a while, if the sun was fortified for its battles with the stars. To gain strength, the sun needed Chalchihuitl, the mysterious ineffable fluid of life energy. The sacred mission of the Triple Alliance, Tlacaelel proclaimed, was to furnish this vital substance to Huitzilopochtli, who would then use it for the sun, postponing the death of everyone on the planet. There was but one method for obtaining this life energy, ritual human sacrifice. To obtain the victims, Tlacaelel said, according to one of Sagun's contemporaries, the sun needed a marketplace where he could go with his army, that is the army of the Triple Alliance, to buy victims, men for him to eat. And this will be a good thing, for it will be as if he had his maize cakes hot from the griddle, tortillas from a nearby place, hot and ready to eat whenever he wishes them. Occasionally, the victims were slaves and criminals, but mainly they were prisoners of war. In this way, the sacred mission of the Triple Alliance became translated into a secular mission, to obtain prisoners to sacrifice for the sun. The Alliance had to take over the world. In Tlacaelel's scheme, imperial conquests were key to the moral combat against evil, explained Miguel Leon Portilla, a Mexican historian who has devoted much of his career to analyzing Mexica thought. The survival of the universe depended on them. Human sacrifice is such a charged subject that its practice by the Triple Alliance has inevitably become shrouded in myths. Two are important here. The first is that human sacrifice was never practiced. The many post-conquest accounts of public death spectacles are all racist lies. It was indeed in the Spanish interest to exaggerate the extent of human sacrifice, because ending what Cortés called this most horrid and abominable custom became a post hoc rationale for conquest. But the many vividly depicted ceremonies in Mexica art and writing leave little doubt that it occurred, and on a large scale. Cortés may well have been correct when he estimated that sacrifice claimed 3,000 or 4,000 souls a year. The second myth is that in its appetite for death as spectacle, the Triple Alliance was fundamentally different from Europe. Criminals beheaded in Palermo, heretics burned alive in Toledo, assassins drawn and quartered in Paris, Europeans flocked to every form of painful death imaginable. Free entertainment that drew huge crowds. London, the historian Fernand Braudel tells us, held public executions 8 times a year at Tyburn, just north of Hyde Park. The diplomat Samuel Pepys paid a shilling for a good view of a Tyburn hanging in 1664. Watching the victim beg for mercy, he wrote, was a crowd of at least 12 or 14,000 people. In most, if not all, European nations, the bodies were impaled on city walls and strung along highways as warnings. The corpses dangling from trees whose distant silhouettes stand out against the sky in so many old paintings are merely a realistic detail, Braudel observed. They were part of the landscape. Between 1530 and 1630, according to Cambridge historian V.A.C. Gatrell, England executed 75,000 people. At the time, its population was about 3 million, perhaps a tenth that of the Mexica Empire. Arithmetic suggests that if England had been the size of the Triple Alliance, it would have executed, on average, about 7,500 people per year, roughly twice the number Cortés estimated for the empire. France and Spain were still more bloodthirsty than England, according to Braudel. In their penchant for ceremonial public slaughter, the Alliance and Europe were more alike than either side grasped. In both places, the public death was accompanied by the reading of ritual scripts. And in both, the goal was to create a cathartic paroxysm of loyalty to the government. In the Mexica case, by recalling the spiritual justification for the empire. In the European case, to reassert the sovereign's divine power after it had been injured by a criminal act. Most important, neither society should be judged, or in the event judged each other, entirely by its brutality. Who today would want to live in the Greece of Plato and Socrates, with its slavery, constant warfare, institutionalized pederasty, and relentless culling of surplus population? Yet Athens had a coruscating tradition of rhetoric, lyric drama, and philosophy. So did Tenochtitlan and the other cities in the Triple Alliance. In fact, the corpus of writings in classical Nahuatl, the language of the Alliance, is even larger than the corpus of texts in classical Greek. The Nahuatl word tlamatini, literally, he who knows things, meant something akin to thinker-teacher, a philosopher, if you will. The tlamatini, who himself was writing and wisdom, was expected to write and maintain the codices and live in a way that set a moral example. He puts a mirror before others, the Mexica said. In what may have been the first large-scale compulsory education program in history, every male citizen of the Triple Alliance, no matter what his social class, had to attend one sort of school or another until the age of 16. Many tlamatinime, the plural form of the word, taught at the elite academies that trained the next generation of priests, teachers, and high administrators. Like Greek philosophy, the teachings of the tlamatinime were only tenuously connected to the official dogma of Tlakelol. To be sure, Plato does have Socrates subtly correct Homer, because the god supposedly couldn't have behaved in the immoral way described by the poet. But by and large, the Greek pantheon on Mount Olympus plays no role in either Plato or Aristotle. But the Tlamati Nime shared the religion's sense of the evanescence of existence. "Truly do we live on earth?" asked a poem or song attributed to Nessahualcoyotl, 1402-72. A founding figure in Mesoamerican thought and the Tlatoani of Texcoco. One of the other two members of the Triple Alliance. His lyric, among the most famous in the Nahuatl canon, answers its own question. "Not forever on earth, only a little while here. Be it jade, it shatters. Be it gold, it breaks. Be it a quetzal feather, it tears apart. Not forever on earth, only a little while here." In another verse, assigned to Nessahualcoyotl, this theme emerged even more boldly. "Like a painting, we will be erased. Like a flower, we will dry up here on earth. Like plumed vestments of the precious bird, that precious bird with the agile neck, we will come to an end." Contemplating mortality, thinkers in many cultures have drawn solace from the prospect of life after death. This consolation was denied to the Mexica, who are agonizingly uncertain about what happened to the soul. "Do flowers go to the region of the dead?" Nessahualcoyotl asked. In the beyond, are we still dead, or do we live? Many, if not most, Tlamati Nime saw existence as Nabokov feared, a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness. In Nahuatl rhetoric, things were frequently represented by the unusual device of naming two of their elements, a kind of doubled Homeric epithet. Instead of directly mentioning his body, a poet might refer to "my hand, my foot," "noma nakshi," which the savvy listener would know was a synecdoche. In the same way that readers of English know that writers who mention the crown are actually talking about the entire monarch and not just the headgear. Similarly, the poet's speech would be his word, his breath. Itilatol ihio, a double-barreled term for truth, is neltilitzli sin tzilitzli, which means something like fundamental truth, true basic principle. In Nahuatl, the words almost shimmer with connotation. What was true was well-grounded, stable and immutable, enduring above all. Because we human beings are transitory, our lives as ephemeral as dreams. The Tlamati Nime suggested that immutable truth is by its nature beyond human experience. On the ever-changing earth, wrote Leon Portilla, the Mexican historian, nothing is true in the Nahuatl sense of the word. Time and again, the Tlamati Nime wrestled with this dilemma. How can beings of the moment grasp the perduring? It would be like asking a stone to understand mortality. According to Leon Portilla, one exit from this philosophical blind alley was seen by the 15th century poet Ayokuan Kuetzpaltzin, who described it metaphorically as poet's will, by invoking the coyote bird, known for its bell-like song. "He goes his way singing, offering flowers, and his words rain down, like jade and quetzal plumes. Is this what pleases the giver of life? Is that the only truth on earth?" Ayokuan's remarks cannot be fully understood out of the Nahuatl context. Leon Portilla argued, "Flowers and song was a standard double epithet for poetry, the highest art. Jade and quetzal feathers was a synecdoche for great value, in the way that Europeans might refer to gold and silver. The song of the bird, spontaneously produced, stands for aesthetic inspiration." Ayokuan was suggesting, Leon Portilla said, that there is a time when humankind can touch the enduring truths that underlie our fleeting lives. That time is at the moment of artistic creation. "From whence come the flowers, the artistic creations, that enrapture man?" asks the poet. "The songs that intoxicate, the lovely songs." And he answers, "Only from his, That is, ometeotels, home do they come. From the innermost part of heaven. Through art alone, the Mexica said, can human beings approach the real. Cut short by Cortez, Mexica philosophy did not have the chance to reach as far as Greek or Chinese philosophy. But surviving testimony intimates that it was well on its way. The stacks of the Nahuatl manuscripts in Mexican archives depict the Tlamatini-Me meeting to exchange ideas and gossip. As did the Vienna Circle, and the French philosophers, and the Taisho period Kyoto school. The musings of the Tlamatini-Me occurred in intellectual neighborhoods frequented by philosophers from Brussels to Beijing. But the mix was entirely the Mexica's own. Voltaire, Locke, Rousseau, and Hobbes never had a chance to speak with these men or even know of their existence. And here, at last, we begin to appreciate the enormity of the calamity. For the disintegration of Native America was a loss not just to those societies, but to the human enterprise as a whole. Having grown separately for millennia, the Americas were a boundless sea of novel ideas, dreams, stories, philosophies, religions, moralities, discoveries, and all the other products of the mind. Few things are more sublime or characteristically human than the cross-fertilization of cultures. The simple discovery by Europe of the existence of the Americas caused an intellectual ferment. How much grander would have been the tumult if Indian societies had survived in full splendor? Here and there we see clues to what might have been. Pacific Northwest Indian artists carved beautiful masks, boxes, bas-reliefs, and totem poles within the dictates of an elaborate aesthetic system based on an ovoid shape that has no name in European languages. British ships in the 19th century radically transformed native art by giving the Indians brightly colored paints that, unlike native pigments, didn't wash off in the rain. Indians incorporated the new pigments into their traditions, expanding them, and in the process creating an aesthetic, nouvelle vague. European surrealists came across this colorful new art in the first years of the 20th century. As artists will, they stole everything they could, transfiguring the images further. Their interest helped a new generation of indigenous artists to explore new themes. Now envision this kind of fertile back and forth happening in 100 ways with 100 cultures. The gifts from 4 centuries of intellectual exchange. One can hardly imagine anything more valuable. Think of the fruitful impact on Europe and its descendants from contacting Asia. Imagine the effect on these places and people from a second Asia. Along with the unparalleled loss of life, that is what vanished when smallpox came ashore. Assigning blame. Weighing loss of such scale, one naturally wants to identify and denounce the responsible party. In the case of the Mexica, the obvious target is Hernán Cortés, who landed near what is now the city of Veracruz on April 22, 1519. An astute politician, Cortés studied the Triple Alliance with a view to dismembering it. The empire, he quickly understood, was anything but unified. Like Tawantinsuyu, it was a patchwork of satrapies rather than a unified state. Indeed, several large groups within the alliance had managed to hang on to their independence, despite being surrounded by hostile forces. Although the empire left the original elites of conquered lands in place, it humiliated them. The people, forced to disgorge ever-increasing tribute to Tenochtitlan, were resentful and bitter. Cortés divined the discontent beneath the alliance's martial display and would later benefit from it. Marching inland from the sea, the Spanish at first fought repeatedly with Tlaxcala, a confederation of 4 small kingdoms. Señorios, seigneuries the Spanish called them, that had maintained its independence despite repeated alliance incursions. Thanks to their guns, horses, and steel blades, the foreigners won every battle, even with Tlaxcala's huge numerical advantage. But Cortés's force shrank with every fight. He was on the verge of losing everything when the 4 Tlaxcala kings abruptly reversed course. concluding from the results of their battles that they could wipe out the Europeans, though at great cost. The Indian leaders offered what seemed a win-win deal.